Okay, so welcome everybody. My name is Carrie, for those of you who I haven't met, fellow practitioner beings at home. Thank you, Tamara, for enthusiastic greeting, appreciation. So for those of you who I haven't met, I'm weaving in a little bit more to the schedule this year. And the theme for tonight and this month is renunciation. So I'm glad you all made it here on a sunny spring evening to talk about renunciation. It really is a beautiful quality and beautiful topic, so we'll explore it together. So as usual, we'll sit for about 40 minutes. I'll offer some light guidance as we practice. If you have your own way of practicing or a way that feels supportive for you tonight, please do that. Just offering a bit of guidance and direction for those who might want or need it. This is a poem by Jennifer Wellwood. It's called Renunciation. Can close the sitting with this. There will always be voices that promise you greatness and glory. They call out from the worldly marketplace. They call out from the spiritual marketplace. They call out from the fill your holes marketplace. They call out from the bigger, better, more marketplace. Do not buy their false promises or purchase their ephemeral wares. What fulfills for a moment is not worth the price of your soul. There are heights that will fill you, but not when you try to ascend them. There are powers that will fill you, but not when you make them your own. There are treasures and there are imitations of treasures. If you have lost your true gold, at least turn away from the glitter. Want only what is true. Want only what is true. This will lead you to the well of your deepest sorrows. Follow that passageway all the way down. Become the dark emptiness of your absent core. Be still. Don't measure the waiting. Be still. Let the waiting become a fire. Be still. Let the fire show you its secret heart, a strand of clear light running through you. Gather yourself there, and the luminous universe opens. In that vast expanse, fathomless, infinite ocean of light, lose yourself and find yourself and become what you already are. So the theme for tonight and this month is the third of the paramis, or the, I think of them as beautiful and potent qualities, strengths, capacities of heart. The third one of these is renunciation. It's called Nekama. And this is one of the least popular Dhamma talk themes ever. It's right up there with rebirth and dispassion, and those go together. But renunciation, for many of us, brings to mind flavor of deprivation, of grimness, of having to get rid of things that I really like, right? So I love this topic because it's mostly translation and a PR problem, as far as I can tell. It's a kind of misunderstanding of the word. So this quality of renunciation isn't at all meant to evoke a kind of grimness and renouncing the world itself, right? Like a turning away completely from the world itself. But it can, if we haven't sort of studied it, given it some time with investigation, it can feel a little bit like someone telling us to go on a diet. And we know how the research now shows that those don't work, right? So I'd like to offer just a few different ways to think about it before I talk about how we might practice with it, that have to do with how, more how I think it's intended, and kind of different translations of that same word. So at the heart of it, this quality of renunciation really has to do with letting go of our compulsions and addictions. So it's very clear all throughout the teachings that this habit of clinging creates a state of dependency. You know, it changes our relationship to experience and creates a state of dependency. And all through the early teachings, this is the very antithesis of freedom, is this relationship of being bound, of being dependent, of not having choice, having a reflexive relationship to different aspects of experience. So one way to think about it is we're not letting go of things themselves. We're letting go of a compulsive relationship to things, our addictions to things. And that in turn frees up energy, space, choice, and also enjoyment. Right? So this quality of being dependent or bound, again, there is a certain pay, we do get a certain payoff from it, but it's not a state of freedom. So right in the definition, in some traditions, is this like enjoyment of letting go, right? Or the enjoyment of freedom. So there's a real developing a taste for the pleasure and the enjoyment of letting go. So at the heart of all Dharma practice is this learning that letting go is a more helpful gesture than acquiring. That letting go is a more helpful gesture than acquiring. So renunciation is a practicing in many ways this gesture of letting go by valuing or enjoying what results from that, right? What is born from that? So in the Tibetan tradition, the word renunciation is translated in some places as the spirit of emergence, which has such a different taste, right, than someone being deprived and lacking. So it has the flavor. This I first heard from the teacher scholar Alan Wallace. It's like coming out of something like confined and cramped and small into something more open, like the open road. So in the early teachings, the ideal of practice is the model often is held up as a monk or a renunciate, right? Somebody who's given up the familiar stream of worldly pursuits and taken up a different path, right? So this, I think, is calls us to an inward movement, even though most of us aren't drawn to be monastics or relinquish householder lives in that way. It has the same, can have the same inward feel of giving up something that is confining, cramped, too small, and moving out into something that has more freedom, is unknown, a bit unknown. So this kind of going forth into the renunciate life for monastics may have this outward form, but for us as lay people, it takes on more of an inward quality, right? Of kind of going against the stream of bigger, better, more, faster, and kind of turning in a direction toward a way of life, a way of being that actually has a much greater chance of fulfilling or speaking to some of our deepest desires as human beings. Right. So this kind of, however you want to think about it, renouncing or letting go of our addictions, or the spirit of emergence, moving from something more confined and dependent into greater openness. I think this is more how renunciation is supposed to, or is meant to inspire us, right? It's meant to inspire us. Yeah. So this is a very different relationship with the world, right? So ne kamma, in the classical definition, it's meant to, or it points specifically to sense desires. So this is the natural desire that we have as humans for more sensory experience. Another experience, that thirst for a better version of what we're having right now, right? And this kind of compulsive relationship, these habits form really quickly. So I'll talk about that a little bit as we go. I think often about my son, one of the joys and kind of sobering aspects of parenting is that you get to see some of this stuff just come online, you know, from a really early age. But we used to be, I remember really early on when my son, who's 10 now, would be walking through a park, And we would kind of take the same route sometimes, the same thing, same path. And we would get into a habit of sitting at a particular picnic bench to have a snack. And it only took a few times, a few weeks, before sitting on that, even seeing the bench, he would say, "I'm hungry." Right? "I'm hungry." Just seeing the bench. So in all of our inquiry here into renunciation, we have to have a lot of compassion and I think give ourselves a lot of space for how quickly habits form. How quickly and deeply we and instinctively we're drawn to desire more sense experience, right? So we have to have a lot of compassionate understanding for that, how quickly those form. And thankfully, our brains are also flexible. And so there's a lot of room for coming out of a habit-driven or a compulsive relationship with experiences, with devices, with habit patterns of mind, with sense experience. There's a lot of room to experience the joy or the freedom of softening or lessening the compulsiveness of that relationship. So sometimes I like to ask people, you know, renunciation can feel like such a big, dramatic, huge thing sometimes, but how many people have felt the draw towards greater simplicity? Yeah. Towards slowing down? Yeah. And towards more spaciousness? Yeah. So these are all draws. These are all natural yearnings towards renunciation, towards letting go. Another way I kind of have liked to define it over the years is making space for what's essential, for what's really most vitally important. So that works in two ways, and I'll talk about both. If we make a little bit of space in this direction of simplicity, slowing down, what is most kind of authentic and valuable tends to come more to the surface, right? We can get a sense of it. Also, when we get more sense of it, yeah, what that taste, relief, ease, spaciousness, freedom feels like, the other forms of desire and clinging tend to be less appealing or alluring. Okay? So it kind of goes in both directions. Tony Packer, a wonderful practitioner, trained in the Zen lineage, but kind of went forward and kind of developed her own like anti-method of practice. And she offered this inquiry, which was when there's a lot of natural curiosity about something, like a sound, and you're really wondering what it is, like what is that sound? There's a natural kind of quieting and stilling of movement. You think, I really want to hear what sound, like what is that? Like, don't we kind of get quiet, heighten our attention, and tune into it? We're naturally still. What is that? So she was describing the naturalness of this slowing down, of the stilling, of wanting to hear in a deeper way what's really going on. Right? So these are natural impulses towards renunciation, towards letting go of a lot of outer grasping at experience. Like, what's next? What's next? What's next? Feeding. And in the spirit of renunciation tonight, I am vowing to not talk too long, because that would be a paradox we don't want, right? So the Buddha had wonderful descriptions of renunciation. He described renunciation in many places as rest. Renunciation as rest. Rest from not having to get to the next thing, next update, not having to get away from what isn't pleasing, not being pulled this way and that way. So if we can sense it or start to feel it as rest, and when some of us may have experienced this on retreat, right? When we think about going on retreat, for some of us, it's like the prospect of silence for a whole weekend or a few days or week, no phones, no entertainment, no anything extra from the outside coming in. For some of us, that sounds like a kind of prison. And often people will say, oh, I could never do that. Yeah, I could never be in silence for that long. And for others of us at other times, maybe people who've experienced that, there can be a longing or a yearning for that kind of simplicity, letting go of deepening in that way. So once we start to have a taste, even coming here tonight, it's an act of renunciation to some degree. Yeah, there were undoubtedly more exciting things that were given up in favor of perhaps a deeper form of listening, or a different sort of pleasure. I'll talk about that a little bit more as we go. We come here into retreat spaces or practice spaces because we have a sense that even though there is a degree of discomfort in this unpleasant experience, that it offers a kind of open road. A kind of rest, right, from the kind of values and momentum and compulsive drive that we can feel in other places. Gil Fronsdell says, when we see renunciation not as limitation, but as unburdening, we can take great delight in feeling free from desire and compulsion. Not as limitation, but as unburdening. So in the early teachings, there's a wonderful exchange in which Ananda, the Buddha's cousin and attendant, comes with this householder to see the Buddha. The householder has this question about living a lay life with all of its sensory input, how to live a lay life. And so this householder, Tapusa, asks Ananda this question, and Ananda says, well, let's go ask the Buddha. And so they come to the Buddha and they ask, So I'll just read a little bit. We are householders who indulge in sensuality, delight in sensuality, enjoy sensuality, rejoice in sensuality. For us, indulging in sensuality, delighting in sensuality, enjoying, rejoicing, renunciation seems like a sheer drop-off. Yet I've heard that in this practice, the hearts of those dedicated to the path actually leap up at renunciation, grow confident, steadfast, and firm, seeing it as rest and peace. So, how is this? He's asking. How is this? How is this that it's not a sheer drop-off, but that actually the possibility of renunciation leads some to confidence, steadfastness, rest, peace? And the Buddha says, even I myself, before my awakening, I thought renunciation is good, seclusion is good, but my heart didn't leap up at renunciation. Didn't grow confident, steadfast, or firm, seeing it as peace. Then the thought occurred to me, what is the cause, the reason why my heart doesn't leap up at this? It must be I haven't seen the drawback of this kind of pleasure. I haven't pursued that with my awareness. I haven't understood the reward or the benefit of renunciation. I haven't familiarized myself with that. That's why my heart doesn't leap up, doesn't grow confident, steadfast, or firm. So he advises this person asking the question, first has empathy for the fact that it can feel like a sheer drop-off, but encourages this investigation into the drawback and of pursuing this kind of pursuit of more and more sense experience, and the drawback of or the benefit or the reward of renunciation. So just familiarize yourself, familiarize your heart, investigate this kind of relationship. So the Buddha said we can't eliminate desire, right? We can't completely repress it. We can't deny it. We can't outsmart it. But this practice points to the middle way between repression, kind of suppressing it, denying it, avoiding it, eliminating it, pretending we don't have it, and indulging every impulse that comes our way. What's in between those two? Yeah. So this is not a straight line. This is an area of investigation, of inquiry. But it also takes familiarizing ourselves with different forms of pleasure. So we'll talk about that in a little bit now. But just to have some reality check around it, I think points to this at the beginning of this sutta also. So the Buddha said, at the beginning, you know, when my heart didn't leap up at renunciation, I too knew that, oh, this is good. This could be helpful for me. Knew it kind of on an intellectual level, but wasn't fully aware. Okay, what is the benefit of this? So Ajahn Chah, said that being a practitioner is knowing about letting go, knowing, perhaps knowing intellectually about the benefits of letting go, but being unable to do so 95% of the time. Right? Or I guess he said 90. I changed the percentage. 90% of the time. So most of the time we have a sense, oh, be good to kind of let go here. But we're not quite able to do it. So I want to spend a little bit of time just going a little bit deeper into how we might actually begin to practice with this, if we are kind of inspired to do so. So in the Jewish tradition, there's a story about two men who go to see a rabbi talking about some of their habits that are kind of leading them into compulsive, addictive behavior around smoking. And so the story goes that Cecil sees Rabbi Golden and asks, "Rabbi, is it permissible for me to smoke while I pray?" "No, no, you may not. That's utterly disrespectful to our tradition," answers the rabbi. Cecil goes back to his friend and tells him what the good rabbi has told him. "I'm not surprised," his friend said. "You asked the wrong question. Let me try." Morris goes over to the rabbi and asks, "Rabbi, would it be okay if I prayed while I smoke?" To which Rabbi Golden eagerly replies, by all means, please, please, my good man, by all means." Right? So, what does this mean? So my own inquiries into renunciation, you know, again, if we're not going to be kind of demanding or repressing, but investigating, is to bring a full awareness into those pockets where we feel like there's still some compulsive behavior operating, right? So not as an arena of self-judgment, but just, they feel to me like pockets of forgetfulness, right? Just pockets where we lose awareness. And just to notice what happens. What are the drawbacks in those areas? So, one of the areas I've been playing with often, and this is a simple example, but hopefully it'll kind of give you a flavor, is the New York Times very intelligently and wisely, their marketing people, put all of their puzzles on one app, right? And so I've noticed, you know, just this is very simple. But at the end of the day, towards the end of the day, when I'm tired and when my son is getting started on his bedtime routine, I'll notice that quite innocently, I would start just doing a quick puzzle, like the Wordle or the spelling bee. And what happens in that moment? There's a quick dopamine hit, right? Of doing something that's finite that actually has an answer. But there's also, in that moment, there, now that it's become a bit habitual, that it becomes that time of day, my mind is tired, and that is the easy path of least resistance. Yeah. So in exploring it, and of course it's not just one puzzle, then it's like two or three, and getting to a certain level or level of proficiency at them. And there is a certain payoff in it, right? It's not that there's no payoff. There is a kind of relief. And the relief is not having to respond to people in that moment, right? Not having to respond to needs. There is a kind of engagement, stimulus, but also rest. But it's not the deepening kind of rest. So with every kind of this sort of compulsive behavior, there's always a kind of tail or like a little bit of hangover. So after doing this for even a few minutes, it's a little harder to re-engage with my son and do the bedtime routine, right? The impulse to linger on the couch for a little bit more is a little bit, it's a little bit harder to kind of come back, right? There's a little bit of a tail or a wake. So we might notice that if we're exploring these pockets. So I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But on the other side, what we can also notice is the pleasure of practice itself. So I was pointing to this in the guided meditation a bit, that we can become kind of fluent or familiar with different kinds of pleasure as well. There's a kind of pleasure that kind of leads to a need for more pleasure. And there's a kind of pleasure that comes from letting go and comes from practice, from quieting, from slowing, from stilling, that tends to have more of a nourishing contentment flavor to it. So it's not always pleasant, but there's a deepening sense of it feels good just to be present with my own experience moment by moment, even when it's difficult, even when it's a bit challenging. There can be a kind of deepening pleasure that arises with practice. So sometimes people need permission to notice this, yeah? Enjoying a sense of silence or space, enjoying a sense of relief at only having one thing or one process to be attending to moment by moment. Noticing a sense of space that can open up between the sort of stimulus and response. Right? So this kind of pleasure helps us deepen in practice. It's I talk to my son about this as the kind of slow pleasure, right? So it's the pleasure of kind of asking him to notice. It's the pleasure of a video game, right? That kind of stimulus and feedback and engagement of the senses, and the kind of slow pleasure of kind of enjoying your embodiment of climbing a tree, right? Or being able to ride your bike and learn and develop. So this is a tough sell for a 10-year-old. He's not too excited yet. But we can notice this difference between a slow kind of pleasure that sort of helps us return to ourselves and our own experience, and the kind of quick hit of dopamine pleasure, yeah? Which isn't bad or wrong. It's just different, right? But it tends to enforce more of a habit energy, needing more. So Judson Brewer, just mentioned this briefly, is a psychiatrist and a researcher, meditation researcher, who talks about habit loops that we get stuck in. So I think I'm talking about them as pockets of forgetfulness or compulsion, but he talks about them as habit loops. I think this is really helpful. So he talks about just the very mechanical, reflexive, instinctual way that habits get formed and then trap us, right? They trap our energy, they trap our attention. So this is really simplifying it, but if you're interested, you can research a little bit deeper. but there's a trigger, a response, and a reward. So every cue, every trigger, we'll have an experience. We'll see a sight. So could see our phones, or an inner experience, like the unpleasantness of being tired at the end of the day. Or we see the picnic bench, right? There's a trigger or a cue, externally or internally. Then there's a behavior that we have tried out a few times in response to that cue, right? So we reach for something, or we shove something away, or we respond in some way. And then there's a reward, or there's a certain kind of payoff. So for things that are in these pockets of forgetfulness, we may really become interested and curious in what the reward is and kind of the mechanical nature of the way that it unfolds, but how it doesn't solve the initial problem of craving. Right? It actually fuels it or creates more of this, more of it. So we can kind of unpack or notice, not in an intellectual way, but by getting closer to the reward, but also the drawback. Right? So we get close to the dukkha of it. This is the way that we learn. Right? Not by thinking or condemning or repressing, but in getting very close to the actual experience. What does this offer? What does it prevent? So in every area, these pockets of forgetfulness or these habit loops, again, we'll notice that kind of incompleteness will drive the whole cycle forward again. The things in themselves are not problems. It's our relationship to them. So if I stay up too late at night watching or consuming or doing something that I know intellectually might not be helpful, in the morning I wake up and I notice that. It has an impact on the way that I sit, on the clarity that's available when I wake up. So these go in, again, two directions. By really valuing the kind of pleasure that practice offers and being willing to investigate the drawbacks of the more compulsive or addictive kind of pleasure. So in this way, our brains are very quite malleable, right? The habits are easy to form, but it is possible to shift them, to experience that coming out of something constricted and coming into something more open, more spacious, where we do have our choice. We do have a choice of how we respond. So this is one of my favorite poems from Naomi Shihab Nye called Fresh. I think it speaks to this quality. It says, to move cleanly, needing to be nowhere else, wanting nothing from any store, to lift something you already had and set it down in a new place. Awakened eye seeing freshly. What does that do to the old blood moving through the channels? So sometimes when we shine the light of awareness on some of these pockets or loops, what happens is we drop down to a kind of deeper level of need, right, that might be there behind the reaching towards something for a quick fix. You know, deeper needs for relaxation, for rest, for community, for nourishment, right? So in turning towards these deeper needs, there's a kind of compassion and a deep honoring of our humanness that can come forward, that can really help bring us out of the loop. Yeah. Doesn't demand that we fulfill it immediately, but we can rest with it. So it's one famous quote that says, you can never get enough of what you never really wanted. It's been a helpful reflection to me, right? You can never get enough of what you never really wanted. That kind of insatiability. So again, we need a lot of spacious, compassionate understanding for ourselves in this. But the promise of practice is really more this open road, this going forth from the kind of the screaming of the world. Like, pay attention to this, this matters, get one of these, get more, get this now, quick, faster, better. And really tuning into a different stream, a different channel. So, Ajahn Suchito, many of you know, a wonderful monk, offers some online Dhamma. We did all through the pandemic, and the other day he was offering a teaching, and at the end he just said so simply and so beautifully, just stay in the stream. Just stay in the stream. So all these things clamoring to like pull us out, pull us out, pull us out. So when we renounce, we're not closing our door, closing doors on the world. We're not renouncing the world. We're letting the world be just the way it is. Right? We're letting people do what they do. We're letting the notifications do what they do, the alerts, all that. Letting sounds do what they do. Impulses happen just as they happen. But we are stepping out of that compulsive responding. So this deeper letting go is sometimes talked about as relinquishment. Yeah, relinquishment. So it's my invitation. We kind of stay in the stream, and not see this again as a steep drop off, right? But as something that has a lot of potential for our freedom, for our unburdening. So why don't we just sit quietly for a moment? So I appreciate your attention tonight in your practice. There's time for a few questions, comments, your own reflections. Love to hear a little bit about what this brings up for you.
I'm not sure if my question is fully formed yet, but I notice my brain in different kinds of spirals sometimes, especially to certain stimuli that can feel very addictive. And I'm wondering, like, when that's happening, when I'm kind of like spinning about a situation or about a person, it feels like there's like an aspect of renunciation that could be helpful in that moment, but it's a real struggle to get out of that, right? It's like, it's not so much like an addiction to a drug where I could just be like, okay, I'm gonna stay in the stream and like not use that thing. It's like in my head, and meditation is of course helpful, but of course that also pops up through meditation. And just wondering if there's any link you can speak to renunciation.
Interesting, everyone could hear that. Can anyone relate to being stuck in spirals of worried or maybe compulsive thinking that you know aren't helpful but are still continuing no matter what? Right. So this is a huge part, and hopefully as we go through the month, you know, tonight focused a little bit more on the sense aspect, but some of our most addictive patterns are inner habits of worry or obsessiveness or just getting snagged and stuck on ways of thinking that aren't helpful. So we can kind of apply some of these same tools as though it were an outward thing. So we can look back and see, okay, what triggered it? Yeah. Is it an unpleasant inner or outer experience? Can we catch the trigger? You know, so many people recently been talking to having trouble sleeping at night. Yeah. So there's, go too far into that as an example, but when certain conditions come together, there's an unpleasant experience, and all of a sudden the mind is on overdrive, right? Spinning, worrying, planning, thinking of things. So we can notice the cue. We can notice the behavior that starts. This is to use Dr. Brewer's kind of formula, but it's very dharmic. It's what the Buddha used too. We can notice what behavior, and a thought form is a kind of behavior. Have you ever noticed that when you're worried about something, it kind of feels like you're working on it? Yeah, it kind of feels like you're doing something. Yeah, you're really figuring it out. But at 2 a.m, are you really figuring it out? not usually. Kind of anxiety, spinning, worrying is a conditioned behavior that we have used to try to solve this problem of an uncomfortable feeling. And so we can feel that there is some, maybe a little bit of a benefit, and that maybe it feels like we're about to get an answer, but it actually doesn't solve the problem. It creates more unpleasantness that drives the cycle further. So to be willing to come close to the initial unpleasantness of the cue, whatever triggered it, but also really seeing that that doesn't work, right? And so what does switching the channel look like in that scenario? It's coming more deeply into the body. Usually if there's a lot of obsessive thinking, there's a feeling there that we don't like or don't want to experience. Might be a feeling of uncertainty, might be a feeling of loss, might be an experience of, heartbreak, heartache, not knowing. So coming closer to that, and there is a kind of, not fun kind of enjoyment, but in just staying with the reality of that experience, not making it worse, there's a kind of a little bit of space and relief that comes with that. Right? So thinking is not it's not bad. It's just not the correct, it's not the most helpful tool for the job. Right? So we can use some of the same tools, but use it in relationship to our own addictive thinking patterns too. And increasing our awareness of the pleasure of practice as well. So again, it doesn't mean practice is always pleasurable, but increasing our awareness of how it feels good just to be aware of this, right? So more to say, I think, over these months, but thank you for that, Sarah. No, most everyone can relate to that to some degree. Because, yeah, even when we let go of the outward behavior, really, the inward cycle continues. Yeah, so this is a practice for working mostly, but not exclusively, inwardly, too. So maybe time for one more quick question if anyone has or comment.
Hi everyone. So my name is Matthew, and so the past week something happened that I thought was relating pretty well to the ethics talk we had last week. But I was not expecting too much so well what you described tonight. So basically, I've been working with this coworker on some project, and I've been doing a lot of work helping him and guiding him to do like the best he could. And came the time for like a presentation, and in the past, I've been a bit like obsessing, almost like being a bit childish about making sure like credits will go to the right people and like recognition will be there. And so came the time that we started to plan for this presentation to be made. And at the time, only his name was on the slide title. And I felt like I was really missing. I mean, I deserve to be there too. But then I started to realize like this guy, like he really deserved like a big win. He deserved to like carry the project and like present it. And so I just basically like renunciated to mention it to him or to ask him to put my name. So I just let it go. And it was really painful because it lasted more than a week where I would work on the slides and I would work on them. And every day I would not see my name on it. And I would think like, this is so painful. But this guy deserves it. I mean, he worked so hard and he probably deserves it more than me, so it's fine. And so I slowly but arrived to a point where I forgot about not having my name there, and I was becoming really happy of like forcing him making the presentation and getting like rewards and all. And so came the day of the presentation, and I was really happy about it and how it was going to unfold. And the best thing actually happened because like 20 minutes before the presentation, he asked me like, oh, by the way, I have a last question. Like, can I put your name on the slides as a co-author? And it was really like a very rare moment for me. I mean, I don't know how you could describe it, but it's a bit like a lot of things that you described tonight. But in the end, I realized that that moment and that whole week and our relationship was like meant like so much more than just having my name there if I asked for it. And that basically no one in the company would have really like noticed it or like think about it. So the net effect would have been not much. But now when I think of the next years working with him, I feel like we have this very close relationship and this like confidence in each other and like kind of mutual respect. And so, yeah, it was really, I guess I went through this renunciation thing this week. Yeah, I don't know, it was... something very, very strong that I never like had before in my professional life.
Yeah, thank you. It's a wonderful example of bringing the sincerity of practice into whatever situation we're in, and really staying with it over time, you know, and letting the fruits come forward, you know. So, and often in a way that we couldn't have strategized or planned our way towards. So thank you for that. Yeah. Ultimately, this renunciation, this letting go, is a, and you did, this is kind of as you described, it has a lot to do with non-harming and sila as well. But it's ultimately an empowering experience, you know, as we're, we're kind of putting our own, like, responsibility for our own minds at the center. Like, we're working with it actively at the, putting it at the center. Yeah. So taking it as practice. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, everyone. Appreciate you staying for the announcements, and also appreciate your reflection on Donna. If you have any questions about that, you can always ask. All the information's online. And go well. Go well. Take care. Mm-hmm. Good night.